Hello, I'm Manila Chan. You are tuned into Modus Operandi, the show that dives deep into global foreign policy and international relations to examine their methods and patterns and its history that reverberates in our lives today. Space is perceived to be neutral territory, regardless of earthly tensions. The final frontier is supposed to be the borderless zone where nationality doesn't exist. But with more and more countries building their own space programs, will we soon see the cosmos as the next battlefield? We'll discuss it. All right, let's get into the MO. We look up at it every day. Most notably, we pay attention to it at night. Space. We look up to the sky at night and marvel at the light delivered by the moon. In the old days, it was a space race between the United States and then the USSR to triumphantly plant the nation's flag on its face. The Soviet Sputnik 1 was the first spacecraft, a satellite to be exact, to be launched into space. That was back on October 4, 1957. A few short years later, in April of 1961, Russian cosmonaut Yuri Gagarin became the first person in space. Then about a month later, NASA astronaut, American Alan Shepard, followed suit, setting off an unofficial space race between East and West. Now on the ground, the Cold War was heating up. The 1960s were a volatile era for the West, with the U.S. being entangled in wars across Southeast Asia and ramped up hostilities against the Soviets. Now, much of that playing out in Cuba and in a divided Germany at that time. Now, in the final year of that tumultuous decade, the U.S. pulled ahead in the space race. July 1969 saw American astronauts Neil Armstrong and Buzz Aldrin becoming the first people to set foot on the moon. The U.S. flag planted proudly on the lunar surface. Now, without conceit nor concession on the ground, the U.S. and USSR would later collaborate in space, culminating in this historic first.
Docking completed.
Docking is completed. Well done, Tom. It was a good show. We are looking forward now.
When we opened Hatch in space, we were opening back on the Earth a barrel in the history of man.
By 1975, the docking of the American Apollo spacecraft to the Soviet Soyuz capsule, American astronaut General Tom Stafford and his Russian counterpart, General Alexei Leonov, seen here in what's now known as the first handshake in space, marking the first joint international mission, the Apollo-Soyuz test project, and what some refer to as the first thawing of relations between the U.S. and Soviet Union. Now, that handshake turned two men from two very different countries into legends. Now, I had the great honor of interviewing Generals Stafford and Leonov many years back. Now, they told me that handshake in space led to a lifelong friendship, BFFs, besties, here on Earth, until General Leonov passed away in 2019 at age 85. But their handshake and subsequent friendship served as a harbinger for relations between their respective home countries, almost mirroring one another. By the 1990s, after the fall of the Soviet Union, the United States and Russia were regularly cooperating in the field of science in space. By the early 2000s, NASA relied on launches to the International Space Station out of the Russian-owned Baikonur Cosmodrome. And over the last two decades, new players to the game. China, India, the EU, Japan, and many others. Believe it or not, a whopping 72 countries have some sort of space program. However, only 14 countries have the ability to launch objects into space. Even fewer, just 6 countries, have functional, substantive space programs in the traditional sense that you're probably thinking. But the most jarring and disruptive of any of these, SpaceX, founded by billionaire Elon Musk, and a couple of other private sector commercial endeavors, such as Blue Origin by Amazon billionaire Jeff Bezos or serial entrepreneur Sir Richard Branson of Virgin. Now, not to mention the tens of thousands of satellites up there used for everything from your GPS to military spying and everything in between. Everyone is up in space. It's getting so bad that space junk is becoming a topic for concern. Because who wants a piece of satellite falling into their yard, right? Well, now, with so many people armed with the technology and worse, weaponry to go into space, a new multipolar space race is brewing. So, as they say, what can go wrong? For that, we'll turn to Professor of Space Law at the University of Nebraska, Professor Franz Vonderdunk. Professor Vonderdunk has served as advisor to the Dutch government, several foreign governments as well, the European Commission, the European Space Agency, the UN, the OECD. The list goes on. Professor, thank you for joining us. First, Professor, you are a space lawyer. What exactly is a space lawyer? I mean, to the surprise of many, myself included, this is an actual area of law. Tell us about this specialty and how it actually works.
Well, that's a great question. And many people, I assume, would, when they hear the word space lawyer, think about suing somebody else in court on a space issue. Well, that is not what most space lawyers do. Not yet. That may change in the future with more and more private space activities. But currently, space lawyers are usually people who are engaged as part of a private sector management team in handling the legal issues on contracts, on complying with licenses. There are space lawyers who work for governments in imposing licenses and developing further regulations on how space activities should be conducted. There are space lawyers involved in intergovernmental organizations like the United Nations or the International Telecommunication Union doing the same type of stuff. Then you have an increasing number of people like me who teach space law in an academic context and do research and investigate, see what the problems are and what the solutions could be. There are also a lot of consultants around. I'm also a consultant. It's part of what I do, which means that I advise private operators, governments, intergovernmental organizations, the Association of Space Explorers, which is basically the global club of astronauts and cosmonauts, all the time on legal issues. And then only at the bottom end, there are perhaps a few people who actually go to court and sue someone else because of a space issue.
Many countries now have a space program. Now, in the old days, it was really a space race between the U.S. and Soviet Union. But today, there is NASA, there's the Russian program, the Chinese have one, India, Europe as a joint effort among various countries. So how will space law work? Is it, I don't know, perhaps comparable to maritime law?
In many respects, it is. And probably the most fundamental comparison is that maritime law, of course, to a large extent, deals with the areas of the high seas, which is where every state is in principle free to do what it wants unless there are specific international obligations constraining that freedom. And the same baseline applies to outer space as well. Outer space is also a free area. I usually refer to it somewhat colloquially as global commons, which kind of gives the idea. It's an international area. There's no single state which can call the tune, which means that space law, the limitations to that freedom have to be developed on an international level by treaty law. And that's also what happens in maritime law. And going back to the first part of the question, the fact that we have more and more states in space, you mentioned only the most important ones, but there are also countries like Brazil and Indonesia and Nigeria, and many smaller countries also getting into the game, means, of course, that you have more and more states who have something at stake. On the one hand, are interested in a proper and fair set of rules on what they do on outer space. They want to be protected, think again about the liability. But at the same time, it makes it more difficult to get all those states on the same page when it comes to what the rules should actually dictate. So in that sense, the development of new international space law is a larger challenge than it was back in the good old days when just needed the Soviet Union and the United States to agree and basically the rest of the world would follow suit.
Currently, several space programs run by both nations and the private sector are once again eyeing the moon. The Chinese have already sent an unmanned explorer to the far side of the moon. NASA intends to go back to the moon in a few years and even stand up a lunar space station. The Chinese have expressed a similar goal. Can any state lay claim to the moon? I mean, if not the whole thing, maybe just parts of the moon?
No, not laying a claim in the sense like you could say, this is now my territory. This is kind of an extraterrestrial province of the United States or China or anything like that. The most important piece of space law, the 1967 Outer Space Treaty, which, by the way, is officially recognized by all important states. Anyone who is something in outer space has signed up to that. So that is really providing the baseline legal regime. That Outer Space Treaty in Article 2 makes very clear that no one can appropriate as a state any part of outer space or of a celestial body.
Can space real estate sales become a thing? And what would that sort of law even look like? Would this look like, I don't know, the wild, wild west in the 1800s with gold miners just simply laying claim to a plot of land? I mean, can one just lay claim to 5 acres on Mars and 20 hectares on Ceres?
Well, in a sense, it has already happened, because there is already 1980. There was an American businessman who managed to convince local authorities that following such laws on how a private person could obtain property over land in the United States in the Wild West, that they applied to the moon, and he claimed the moon and has since become a multimillionaire by selling parts of the moon. But this, strictly speaking, is fraud, because the fact that he used US laws to apply to the moon is in evident contradiction to the fact that the moon is not part of the United States. So whatever laws the United States, and that of course applies to other countries as well, may have in place for allowing private citizens like you and me ownership over private part of land, that law only applies to the country at issue. And since the moon cannot be part of any country at down on Earth because of Article 2 of the Outer Space Treaty, which I spoke about earlier, this does not apply to the moon. Again, it hasn't kept many people from buying parts, but each time, there was a period when this was really high on the news, and every 2 weeks I got an email or a phone call from someone saying, you know, can I buy this? Should I buy this? I bought this. What does it mean? And I was always tempted to say, you know, you can buy the same plot for half the price for me, which tells you, you know, this is basically, I don't want to use dirty words, but you can understand what I'm saying, which means fraud, right?
All right. So for some trusting individuals out there dreaming of owning a piece of the moon or Mars or another celestial body, it may be prudent to check with a space lawyer before proceeding with that deal. But for nations, lawyers are an essential necessity in this uncharted territory more than ever. When we return, we'll discuss the growing possibility of militarizing the moon. Sit tight, the MO will be right back.
Frank, I'm originally from Philadelphia. Got in the movement in 88. I was 13 going on 14.
We were violent towards those people because we believed that we were the superior race. We were here first, and this is our country.
Being part of that movement, I got to feel a sense of power when I felt powerless. I got attention when I'd felt invisible and accepted when I'd felt unlovable.
So Life After Hate is an organization that was founded by four ex-skinhead, neo-Nazi, white supremacists in the US and Canada. and they found each other, and they knew that they wanted to help other guys get out.
There's two parts to getting out of a violent extremist group. The first part is disengagement, which is where you leave the social group. And then the next part is de-radicalization, where the belief systems and the ideology are removed.
It was very impactful when someone finally came along with no fear, no judgment. He heard my story, did nothing to challenge it, but validated it.
So what we've got to do is identify the threats that we have.
It's crazy.
Confrontation, let it be an arms race.
Who is on offense? Very dramatic development.
I personally am going to resist.
I don't see how that strategy will be successful.
Very critical time.
Time to sit down and talk.
A bit more complicated now, with not only sovereign states eyeing the moon once again, but now we have entered the era of the commercialization of space. Private sector space tourism is now a reality, and so is the potential of militarizing the moon. Professor Frans van der Donck is staying with us to continue this conversation. So, Professor, there are thousands and thousands of satellites floating around up there. Space tourism is fast becoming tangible for more people. I mean, still a very small, elite few, but still, it's a reality now. Is there any fear within the space community that space junk or space traffic could cause catastrophic or even deadly accidents? I mean, how is, I don't know what else to call it, but how is space commuting going to work?
Well, that's absolutely a very important issue. So far, the main concerns are with damage caused in outer space, because there are not that many space objects which would survive re-entry. You would basically talk about some of the larger satellites which are very well shielded, or maybe the space station. You may recall the threat of the Russians a few months ago that they would perhaps consider dropping the space station on some country which was opposing them. But that's not, I mean, there's just a few space objects which are big enough to survive re-entry and not burn up. So the main concerns currently are with stuff happening in outer space. And that is a huge concern, not just for space tourism, but for any satellite activity. Part of the problem is that because of the speed with which these particles fly, even a tiny particle can pierce an astronaut suit or cause great damage to a multi-billion dollar satellite. So these concerns are absolutely there. I want to say that as a lawyer, as a law professor, law can obviously help mitigate that. But what really needs to be done is the willingness, is to develop a willingness to spend money on that. There have already been technological plans hatched to take out the most dangerous satellites, which are no longer in control, or to clean up by way of vacuum cleaners or stuff like that. Certain parts of Earth which are already being polluted with space junk or space debris, as the formal name goes.
There are fears that given the political problems here on Earth, that it has bled over into space, where, you know, once upon a time, the so-called final frontier was where Earthlings of all nationalities were able to not only coexist, but cooperate for the greater good of mankind. Now we're seeing countries withdraw from the ISS program. We're seeing Earth hostilities and animosity convey in space programs. The newest example, the ESA, the Europeans, canceling their future contract with Roscosmos, the Russian program. What would happen if this trend continues?
Well, it's certainly a bad trend. Let me, you know, there's no two ways about it. This is bad for the international community. This is bad for the space endeavor, et cetera, et cetera. At the same time, there are a few issues which make me believe that there is still a possibility that it will not end in the worst case scenario, that space would become part of a war or something like that, right? For one, despite all the bad stuff going back between Russia and the United States, they still work together on the space station. It's probably the only area in the world where they still work together. But just a couple of days ago, SpaceX, a US company, flew a U.S. astronaut, two U.S. astronauts, Japanese, and a Russian astronaut to the space station. So for whatever reason and through whatever miracles, they have been able to keep the Space Station Corporation outside of the all the conflicts that are going on elsewhere, and the boycotts and the mutual mudslinging and stuff between Russia and the United States. Of course, no one knows how much longer that will survive, but it tells you that there is something special about space. And for example, taking a broader picture, going also back to the space junk issue, there is an understanding, certainly on those who really are engaged in space, that in this case, humanity is really in the same boat, in one lifeboat, which is called Earth, and everybody's in the same boat, everybody's in that boat together. So there is this feeling or this idea that may prevent us from, you know, or prevent some of us at least from simply thinking that they can use space for their own limited national benefits. If you talk about space junk doesn't discriminate. You may blow up somebody else's satellite, but the piece may also come back to haunt your own satellites in your own space endeavors. And it's ironic that when last December, which is even before the Ukraine war, the Russians blew up their own satellite in outer space just to show some muscle, to show that if something bad happens, we are able to shoot down American satellites, worst comes to the worst, just the target practicing. The debris of this threatened the space station, and in context of the International Space Station, there are safety procedures, which mean that if certain parts of space debris come too close for comfort to the space station, everyone in the space station scrambles into whatever vehicle is docked at that point in the space station, a kind of a lifeboat situation, so that if it really hits within a minute, they can leave. In that situation of the Russian space debris threatening the space debris, six people from the space station had to move to the lifeboat, and three of them were Russians. So it tells you that by shooting up your own stuff, you also can damage your own space operation. So again, it doesn't unfortunately preclude bad things from happening in outer space, but at least it puts a kind of a check on the feasibility of doing the worst, noting moreover that I don't think anyone has yet figured out how space could contribute in terms of actual weaponization and stuff like that to a war on Earth. Space can be used for all sorts of reconnaissance purposes, and it has been used, including in military conflicts. But if you really want to harm an opponent in a warlike situation, there are easier and much less costly ways to do that than to use your space infrastructure.
Donald Trump was mocked for launching Space Force, but the Star Wars program actually existed during the Reagan years. And after the fall of the Soviet Union, that program went dormant. Now that Space Force is an official branch of the U.S. military, is there cause for concern that space will also become militarized?
Not so much as people think. For starters, let me make it clear that space has been actually militarized from the start. The major reason for the space race between the Soviet Union and the United States was to use this technology for reconnaissance purposes, for spying, if you will. And there were some other concerns as well, like prestige. Both countries wanted to show the rest of the world that their political system was the superior one, and one way of doing that was winning the space race. But there was also clear military considerations. And from the get-go, both sides used satellites for military purposes. So when people talk as if space is about to militarize, that's a gross misconception because it has been militarized from the start. What is not militarized, and where also militarization is actually prohibited, is actual celestial bodies such as the Moon and Mars. So there you cannot find, in coordination, in conformity with the Outer Space Treaty, you cannot find any military base, any military maneuver, any stationing of weapons. But that does not apply to the void of outer space. So that's number one. And so far, as far as I know, no weapons have actually been used or tested on the Moon. The only thing which is possible on the Moon is that you use military personnel for clearly scientific purposes. And again, we should realize that out of the 12 Apollo astronauts that actually set foot on the moon, 11 were military or former military. They were Navy pilots or Air Force pilots. So it's clear that that is sort of a misconception. Now, going to the Space Force in particular, yes, much fun has been made of that. I'm not sure, to be honest, whether Trump actually realized what a Space Force would be able to do. He's probably had these, you know, these gun troopers, these star troopers in mind, carrying guns and roaming over the moon in order to fight anyone threatening U.S. interests. Well, that's not what the Space Force necessarily is all about. We should realize that the Russians and the French and the Chinese have their own space forces. So when it comes to assessing whether this means an escalation of the risks of an actual conflict in outer space, that actually brings us to the intelligence realm. I simply don't know whether this this move on the U.S. part is a reaction to Chinese and Russian activities boosting their space force, in which case it's a reactive, it's a reaction to an escalation provoked by the other side, or to which extent the development of a space force, and even more importantly, if that will happen, which is still a big if revamping and ramping up of this, of the actual activities, the military activities of the US and outer space, whether that is initiating the escalation and that would probably trigger some reaction from the Russians and the Chinese. So it's, that's more of an intelligence view on who is to blame for escalation, depending upon your knowledge of what's going on there. And I don't have that knowledge.
Professor Franz von der Dunk of the University of Nebraska, thank you so much for sharing your expertise with us.
Thank you very much.
Well, I guess space is sort of like the paradox of Schrodinger's cat. The cosmos belong to no one, yet everyone at the same time. So it's up to all of us on Earth to agree that up there, we can't do the same that we've always done down here. That's going to do it for this week's episode of Modus Operandi, the show that digs deep into foreign policy. I'm your host, Manila Chan. Thank you for tuning in. We'll see you again next week to figure out the MO.